We've gone through Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's dream. We've gone through Daniel chapter 7 this morning. I want to just hit a couple of little points again on chapter 7 before we move into chapter 8. I think, Tim, you had some comments about, whether or not these kingdoms could possibly be contemporaneous with each other or not, or whether they had to be sequential based on the language. And I just wanted to point out a few things from the text in Daniel chapter 7 that I believe, at least if not requires, strongly implies the sequence.
Can I make one comment real quick?
Yes, you may.
It's not that I don't think they're not sequential.
Yes.
It's that I don't think it's required that they be the same as Daniel 2.
Okay.
That's all. I think it's possible that these four beasts, because of other really strong language and really strong descriptive things about these beasts, could be yet four kingdoms quick in the future. That's all. That's my point.
All right. Well, I still want to comment on whether they're sequential or not. For one thing, I think that the statement about the first kingdom, that a about the man's heart being given unto it, the beast, the first beast, the lion, I think that's a reference to Nebuchadnezzar and what occurred in Daniel chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar was humbled by God, he was driven insane, and then God restored him, his sanity back to him. And the heart of a man that was given to him is that humble heart that acknowledges who he is as a man in relation to God and does not elevate himself in the way that Nebuchadnezzar did at the beginning. So in my opinion, that particular point links that first animal with Nebuchadnezzar. All right, now that you might disagree with that, some might disagree with that, but I think that's fairly obvious from the text. Also, there are statements that that are, for example, it uses ordinal numbers instead of cardinal numbers when it's referring to these animals. It talks about the first, it talks about the second, and it talks about the fourth. And those ordinal numbers are being used in relationship with a verb that's used here in, hang on one second. It's in verse 3 of chapter 7, it says, four great beasts came up, and the verb came up is then, the order in which they came up is then listed by labeling them first, second, it's not specifically said third, but fourth one is specifically said fourth. So these are ordinal numbers. Ordinal numbers are normally used in the sequence. And then, of course, in verse 23, he gives, you could say, well, that's the order in which Daniel saw them. That doesn't necessarily mean that's the order in which they appear. But it is clear that that is the case in verse 23 when the interpretation is given. And it says, the fourth beast, which means the fourth animal that Daniel saw, shall be a fourth kingdom. And so it's clear that in the literal interpretation of the vision, that it is a sequence of kingdoms, at least in my opinion. That's pretty obvious. Anyway, I just wanted to just mention that briefly before we actually get into chapter 8. Now, something else about this chapter is that, again, I believe it links Nebuchadnezzar as the first with the final ending of it, which is the same as Nebuchadnezzar's dream, which was what? The coming of the kingdom of God, right? So you've got, in my opinion, you've got those two anchor points there as well. Not to mention all the other similarities between them. All right, we won't belabor that point. In chapter 8, Daniel has a second vision, and this time it says it's in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. Now this is two years later. The first one was in the first year of King Belshazzar. We're now at about 15 years before the end of the Babylonian exile. And so Daniel has this second dream. The second dream is a clarification of, in my opinion, it's a clarification of the little horn that he saw in the previous vision, and where this little horn comes from. What is the origin of this little horn? And I believe that this passage actually begins to identify who this little horn is. Let me also say, before we get into the passage, that Chapter 8 of Daniel is one of the most disputed passages in Daniel. And one of the reasons why is because almost all historians, biblical historians, say that the details in this chapter are clearly bringing us to Antiochus Epiphanes and his defiling of the temple. And if you look at biblical commentaries, you'll see that that's the case. But there's only one small problem, well, there's two small problems with that interpretation. The first problem is that this person is said to encounter Christ. Antiochus was dead long before Christ came. All right? And the second problem is, well, I'll tell you what. We'll point it out when we get to it. Let's start reading in chapter 8, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me at the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was at Shushan, or it's actually Susa in some translations, which is a city that still exists in Iran today. The citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him. Nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will, and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth or land, without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran to him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacking the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great, and when he had become strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. We're seeing the same patterns appearing here, aren't we? In this particular one, we see the four divisions, which we saw in chapter 7 with the leopard, right, that had the four wings and four heads and all that kind of stuff. All right, verse 9. And out of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the hosts of heaven, and it cast down some of the hosts and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth to the down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said, for 2,300 days. Then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Then it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood. And when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. And he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep and my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you what will happen in the latter time of the indignation, for the appointed time, the end shall be. The ram which you saw, having two horns, They are the kings of Media and Persia. Now he's starting to name names, which he hasn't done previously, right? We've assumed those names, but he's naming them now for sure. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn between its eyes is the first king, and that, of course, is Alexander the Great. And as for the broken horn and the four which stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, now this is a critical statement that you really should underline there in the beginning of verse 23. It says, in the latter time of their kingdom. Who is theirs here? What kingdom? Right, that's right. The kingdoms of the four generals that took over Alexander's kingdom when it was broken up. Okay? And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully, and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. He shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. Now, who is the prince of princes? Christ. I mean, he's identified as that actually in chapter 9. He's referred to as Messiah the Prince in chapter 9. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. And the vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true, therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. Now, as you can see, historically, this appears to be talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. You all know who Antiochus Epiphanes was, right? Most of you know who that was. All right, well, when Alexander's kingdom was divided up among his generals, the largest segment of that kingdom was the Seleucid Empire, which was centered in Syria. Right? The capital was Antioch in Syria, just north of Israel. And the kingdom extended to a good portion of what is today modern Turkey, to the west, and it extended a great deal to the east, all the way through Persia, today's Iran, Iraq, all the way up to the border of India. And it also included the Promised Land. It included Israel at certain times. One of the other divisions of Alexander's kingdom was Egypt. The Ptolemies were the kings of Egypt. And there were two other divisions, which we really don't need to talk about. They were fairly minor divisions. They were Macedonia, which is today's Greece, and the western part of Turkey. All right, but those two were small and they were fairly weak. But the Seleucid Empire and the Egyptian Empire, those two empires were fairly strong. And what happened right after Alexander's death, when his kingdom was divided up, is that there were these constant wars between these four divisions. And they were always invading each other and trying to take territory. And there was this big, long series of wars between them. And unfortunately, the two most powerful, that being Syria to the north of Israel and Egypt to the south of Israel, Israel was caught right in the middle of the two biggest ones that were constantly feuding with each other. All right? And so unfortunately, Israel kind of passed back and forth in its territory between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, as far as having control over them. And whenever these wars were taking place, and Syria is trying to invade Egypt, and Egypt is trying to invade Syria, and all this stuff's going on, in order to get from one to the other, all these armies are marching up and down the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, right through Israel. All right? Well, it's called the King of the North when we get to chapter 11. These battles are actually defined in some detail in Daniel chapter 11. The kingdom to the north, the Seleucid Empire, and the kingdom to the south was called the Southern Kingdom, or the King of the South. And we have these kings in succession. When one king would fall, his son would take his place, and the wars would continue. And they went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And anyway, we had a series of kings by the name of Antiochus from the north. And there was, we'll talk about the different kings when we get to chapter 11, where it actually names them by name and talks about their specific exploits. But suffice it to say for now that the Antiochus IV from the northern kingdom was, he also gave himself the title Epiphanes. Does anybody know what Epiphanes means? It means manifest, and he actually had on his coins Antiochus Theos Epiphanes. Theos is the Greek word for God. So it was essentially Antiochus the Manifest God. That was his title that he assumed. Anyway, Antiochus, in one of his expeditions against Egypt, he made his took his army down to try to overthrow the southern kingdom. He went through Israel, and when he got down about to invade Egypt, the Roman Empire, by this time the Roman Empire was really swelling and swallowing up a lot of the territories that were that bordered this northern kingdom. All right, so the Roman Empire was really on its advance, growing and swallowing up all these kingdoms. Well, the Roman Empire, the Egyptian Empire, went in league with the Romans, asked them to come to their defense. The Romans sent ships down to the coast where Antiochus' army was coming to attack the Egyptian kingdom. And the Roman general, you know, left the ships. He met Antiochus' army as it was about to invade Egypt. And he drew a line in the sand, and this is where the expression line in the sand actually comes from today. It comes from this incident. This Roman general told Antiochus, if you attack Egypt, you're attacking Rome. Right? And said, if you do that, our armies are coming against you as well in defense of Egypt. And Antiochus was like, he had to make a decision. Here he is, all the way down, almost into Egypt with his armies. He's got to decide, is he going to go ahead and take on Rome also, or is he going to turn around and go home with his tail between his legs? And the Roman general drew a circle in the sand around him because he wanted time to contemplate. And the Roman general said to him, you're going to give me your decision before you leave this circle. Right? And that was it. So anyway, Antiochus knew he was outwitted. He knew there was no way he could take on Egypt and Rome at the same time. And so, like a wounded puppy, he turned his army around and headed back up through Israel, back home to Syria. Well, as you can imagine, he had been humiliated. And when he got back to Jerusalem, he took out his anger on the people of Israel. This is where the story of Hanukkah comes from. He went into the temple of God. He erected a statue of Zeus, or some say Jupiter, same God, it's just a Roman or the Greek name. In the temple of God, he sacrificed a pig on the Jewish altar. He forbid the Jews from worshiping their God. He insisted that they worship the Greek gods. Instead, he forbid them from circumcising their children, from observing the Sabbath, from eating kosher. He forced them to eat things that were contrary to the law of Moses, and all this was under penalty of death. Well, the thing is, a large number, perhaps the majority, of the Jews complied with his demands. They abandoned God's law. They decided to adopt the Greek gods. And then there was this time of, for 3 years, there was this time of guerrilla warfare. There was a band of priests, temple priests, the Maccabees. Right? You know, some of you know the story. And even though they had been run out of Jerusalem, the temple was defiled and all this, they began to use guerrilla warfare tactics against Antiochus' army. And over a period of 3 years, they defeated the army that Antiochus had stationed there in Israel. They drove his army out, and they cleansed the temple of God, and they returned the temple worship according to the law of Moses. All right, and that's the story of Hanukkah. And of course, you know that they celebrated the 8 days of the cleansing of the temple and so forth. Now, what Antiochus did is when he defiled the temple and when he defiled the altar by sacrificing swine on the altar, that made that altar unclean, and God's sacrifices could not be offered there anymore until it was cleansed according to the rituals and the law of Moses, right, which took place exactly 3 years later. In fact, Josephus tells us that it was 3 years to the very day from the time that Antiochus defiled the altar until Judah Maccabee and his troops defeated them, and the day that they began the 8 days of cleansing of the temple and they began offering sacrifices on the altar again was 3 years to the day. Okay. Now, what is that problem I talked about before? Some people, they read this passage of scripture and it's really very clear that these events are referring to what happened with Antiochus Epiphanes. It says in verse 23, it says in the latter time of their kingdoms, and it's talking about those four divisions of Alexander's kingdom. And it couldn't have been much later than this because those kingdoms were all swallowed up eventually by the Roman Empire. Alright? So as they existed then, they don't exist now. They became a part of the Roman Empire. And so these events took place before the Roman Empire swallowed up those kingdoms. But how then do we account for the fact that he is this same man, Antiochus here, is said that he will rise up against the Prince of Princes, which is a term that seems to refer to Christ. And the other problem is this. The angel says how long the temple is going to be defiled and how long the daily sacrifices are no longer going to be offered in the temple until the temple is cleansed. How long is it according to this passage? While I get a drink of water, you can look that up. 2,300 days, right? That's what it said. Some people interpret this passage as referring to Antiochus, but they cannot explain the 2,300 days. Yes?
It's also just partially an assumption, but it sounds like what you were saying before is that but he shall be broken about human being. Or human being sounds exactly like the Daniel 2 statue.
Sounds like the what?
Daniel 2 statue gets taken out without...
At the end times.
At the end.
Yes, but how did Antiochus die? Does anybody know how Antiochus Epiphanes died?
His son is broken.
No.
Words and stuff.
Stephen. Yes, Antiochus, what happened was after he subjugated the Jews and he left his army there, he actually went east to put down a rebellion out there in Persia, near actually the far eastern area of his empire. And while he was there, he got news that the Jews had overthrown his army that he had stationed in Israel and had killed his guards and had cleansed the temple. And almost immediately, he was seized by these internal pains inside of him, and it says he bent over and his bowels came out and he died in agony. Far away, he was not buried because, in fact, it says that he, because of this stuff that was secreting out of him, that he stunk so bad that he couldn't even stand himself, and his troops couldn't even stand to be near him until he died in this awful, awful agony. And, of course, the Jews claim that God struck him down. And really, that's probably not far from the truth, because we have other examples where God struck people down in very similar ways. In fact, he struck down one of the kings of Judah in the same way, and his intestines came out. And in fact, for those of you who are not aware of this, how many of you think that Elijah was caught up into heaven and went up to be with God? Well, according to the Bible, about 14 years after that incident, Elijah the prophet wrote a letter to one of the kings of Judah and told him that this was going to happen to him, and it happened to him. And I don't think he made a paper plane out of it and sent it down from heaven. All right, the chronology is actually right there in the Bible. Elijah didn't get caught up into heaven where God is. He was just taken to another location. All right, that's just a little caveat for those of you who think Elijah's up there somewhere. The Bible says no man has ascended into heaven except the one who came down from it. All right, that's John 3:13, in case you're wondering. Anyway, how do we account for this 2,300 days? Now, Josephus tells us, and also the book of Maccabees, those of you who have a Roman Catholic Bible, you know that there's 1st and 2nd Maccabees in the Roman Catholic Bible. Now, the books of Maccabees are the story of Antiochus Epiphanes, how he did all these things to the nation of Israel, how they cleansed the temple. All this is in the book of Maccabees. They're apocryphal books. They're probably not inspired, but they are probably a fairly accurate record of the history of these things. According to both Josephus and the book of Maccabees, it was exactly 3 years to the day from when the temple was defiled, the daily sacrifices stopped, until the day that they cleansed the temple of God and resumed the animal sacrifices, 3 years to the day. How many days is 3 years to the day?
1,080.
I'm sorry?
1,080.
1,080?
Jewish calendar.
Jewish calendar, are you counting, are you using a lunar month? Okay. How long is a lunar year? 354 days. How long is a month, a lunar month?
Yeah.
You're close, Tim. It's 29 and a half days. It averages out to 29 and a half days as a lunar month. What is a lunar month? Let's define a lunar month.
One cycle.
Very good. Excellent. It's from one new moon to the next new moon. Okay, so it's exactly one cycle of a month. Now, normally the Jews will alternate their months, 30 days, 29 days, 30 days, 29 days. But they also confirm it by spotting the new moon. All right, but if you average it out, it comes out to 29.5 days. All right, now, if you multiply that times 12 months, it's 354 days. All right, that's a lunar year. That's 12 lunar months. Now, you also have to understand that the Jews intercalate their calendars, because when you go by a lunar year, which they do, after 2 to 3 years, your seasons start to get out of sync, because the year is a little bit shorter than a solar year, which is linked to the seasons. All right, so the harvest starts drifting backwards in the year after about 3 years. And so approximately 2 to 3, occasionally 4 years, they will add an extra month, so you have a year that has 13 months. But if you assume that this period of time does not have that added month, which it may not have, okay? Let's assume it's a standard year, a normal year, not an intercalated year that falls within these 3 years. How many days do we have now in 3 years, Stephen, with your corrected math? 3 years to the day. 354 times 3. You guys have calculators on your phones. What is it? 1062. All right, how long did the prophecy say that the sacrifices would cease until the temple is cleansed and the sacrifices resume? How long does it say? 2,300. So that's more than double. Go ahead, Jim.
Are you going to comment sometime about whether this phrase evenings and mornings refers to evening sacrifice and morning sacrifice, therefore
be half the time? No. Because that doesn't work out either. If you think, well, he's talking about the individual sacrifices as opposed to the number of days, because there were two per day. It's not actually, that wouldn't even be long enough, because there were four on the Sabbath days. So you have to say two sacrifices per day for the 6 days of the week, and then four on the Sabbath. There were two in the morning and two in the evening. And when you add all those sacrifices up, it comes out much too short for this period of time. Now, some people say, well, he's talking about the end times. This is not even about Antiochus Epiphanes. He's talking about the Antichrist, because the Bible says that the Antichrist is going to do exactly the same thing. In fact, it's called the abomination of desolation in Daniel, what Antiochus did. He uses that exact phrase in chapter 11, referring to Antiochus. And Jesus talked about this also being in the future, because Jesus said, who lived, you know, 200, almost 200 years after this, Jesus said, when you therefore see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, you know, then let him who is in the mountains flee. And so Jesus said that this is going to happen again in the future, right? So some people say, well, this is not really talking about Antiochus himself. It's talking about the Antichrist in the future, and that he's going to defile the temple, and that's going to be for 2300 days. Well, guess what? According to Revelation chapter 13, the Antichrist, when he defiles the temple, it's going to be for 42 months. How many days is 42 months on the lunar calendar? Anybody? 1260? I don't think so.
1239.
354 times 3.5. Somebody just do the math. Real quick. What is it? 1239 days. That doesn't fit the 2300 days either. Now, let me tell you, this is a real problem. If you look this up, this passage up in Bible commentaries, nobody has the answer to this, except the Seventh-day Adventists. They think they have the answer to this, and that is, it's not literal. It's not really 2,300 days. It's really 2,300 years. And it's talking about the time from when Daniel made the prophecy until Jesus comes. But oops, that turned out to be 1840-something, and he didn't come. So now they allegorize that's actually, you know, something that happened in heaven. They do what the Jehovah's Witnesses and everybody else does when their chronology doesn't work out. Right? They just make it some spiritual thing. Jesus entered into the Holy of Holies in heaven, and, you know, he started some pre-judgment thingy or something or other. You know, Jehovah's Witnesses do this too. Alright? That's the Seventh-day Adventist solution. But if you look at your Bible commentaries, I mean the really good Bible commentaries, the ones that have been around for a long time, that have grappled with this, and nobody can explain it. They don't have the answer. But I want to give you something today. And this is, again, you can take it for what it's worth. This is an opinion that I happen to have that I come to fairly recently. But what I want you to do is I want you to calculate this out for me, those of you who have a calculator. 354, I want you to calculate the period of time that Antiochus, that the temple was desolate under Antiochus. It was 3 years of 354 days, all right? Figure that out. What was it again?
1,062.
And now I want you to add to that the 42 months that, according to Revelation, the Antichrist is going to do the same thing. 42 months. Remember, a month is 29 and a half days. So multiply that, 29 and a half times 42. Take your total, add it to the other number, and tell me what you have.
2,301.
Now, the Jewish calendar is unique in that they don't use astronomical time. That is, see, our calendars and the projections that they give us are based on their actual calculations of when the moon passes between the earth and the sun in a direct line, and that's a new moon. But on the Jewish calendar, it's all done observationally. Okay? And it takes about a day after that occurs before it can actually be seen and spotted. Now, a Jewish calendar, whenever you have a period of months or years on the Jewish calendar, they do average out equal to, you know, these periods. But the first sighting of the new moon can be a day or 2 days after the actual new moon occurs, which means this. There's always a variable, depending on your observation, of 1 to 2 days either way whenever you're calculating a period of time that is more than a month. No, it's not the weather. It's not just the weather. Because the new moon, when the new moon occurs, it can occur at different times of the day. Okay? Because it has to do with the moon's revolving around the earth. But depending on where the earth itself is spinning, you might be able to see it, or it might occur a little bit earlier before sunset, before it's dark enough so you can't see it. And if you can't see it, then it's not calculated until the following day, when you can see it. All right? So there's always a variable. Anytime you're dealing with more than 1 month, more than one lunar cycle on the Jewish calendar, from a biblical perspective, all right, not from a scientific, not from the dates that you get from NASA's website, all right? Because they're going precisely by the second whether you can observe it or not, all right? But the way it was calculated in biblical times, there's always a 1 to 2 day variable with regard to that, all right? So you can never have a precise number unless you actually observed the entire period of time, all right? So what I'm telling you is, if you take the period of time that, according to Josephus, according to the book of Maccabees, that the temple was desolate without its morning and evening sacrifices, the period according that was defiled when Antiochus did it, and you add to that the period when Antichrist is said to do this again, he's going to continue for 42 months, and you do it precisely based on the lunar calendar, which is what the Jews used, it comes out to anywhere from 2,299 to 2,301 days. It's right there in that range of observable time. All right, now, yes?
So some are saying this is Antiochus, and some are saying it's Antichrist, and they're saying this. But as far as calculus, both?
I'm saying that the prophecy applies to both.
Okay.
It's giving us a total, yes?
I'm saying that the priests at the temple are the ones who are responsible for deciding the book and declaring.
And declaring.
The thing, so. It's not like the
ball
dropping in Times Square.
No. No. It's going to, we always, whenever we're dealing with these times, we always have to factor in that variable. All right. Now, if you're talking about 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, it doesn't matter because the new moons average out. So it's only going to be off by up to 2 days. Even if we're talking about 1 year or we're talking about 20 years. All right. You still only have about that much variable. All right. Are you guys following me? Now, why would God give the time period as what appears to be a single prophecy about a single man and what he would do, but yet say that the time of the desolation of the temple and combine what Antiochus did with what the Antichrist is going to do in the tribulation? Yes. Okay. Wow, that's pretty profound. Thought. Say that louder. Now, would that account for this prophecy if that was the case? It would, wouldn't it? It would account for it. Not only that, the language of this statement, he's going to take away the daily sacrifice. It's said, the same thing is said of the Antichrist. Jesus, or this is referred to as the abomination of desolation, what he did to the temple. Jesus referred to the Antichrist doing the same thing, committing the abomination of desolation. Now, we have in the Bible, we have statements in Revelation about this beast who received a deadly wound, and then his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And if you look at pop eschatology, people talking about, you know, the end times and the Antichrist, they always talk about how he's going to be assassinated and then he's going to come back, right? Have you heard that before? I'm sure you guys have heard that, right? But there's also prophecy in Revelation chapter 17, chapter 13, it talks about the beast who was wounded by the sword and then he lived. Chapter 17, it says the beast who was and is not, but yet is. Now, John is writing from his perspective, and if he says was, he's talking about something earlier than him. And now it is not now when John wrote, but yet it is again in the future. We see these kinds of hints and these kinds of statements. We have another statement in chapter 17 of Revelation where it talks about this beast, the end time beast, being the eighth, but one of the seven. And there were seven sort of antichrists prior. And he's the eighth one, but yet he's one of the seven. You know, we have these kinds of statements going on. And I think, this is my opinion. Now, when we get to chapter 11, I'm going to give you more evidence for this. All right? Because in chapter 11, he talks about Antiochus in terms that are absolutely unmistakable. But then he keeps talking about the same person as being in the end times without a change of subject. We're going to look at that, not tonight, but we'll look at it in a future class. And people have struggled with that. Expositors of the Bible in this passage and in chapter 11 have fought over for years. Is this about Antiochus or is this about Antichrist? And they keep going back and forth. Well, guess what? Is it about Antiochus or is it about Antichrist? Yes, I think it is. All right, now, you can be thinking, now that sounds just crazy. You know, that Antichrist is going to be somebody who comes back from the dead, who's been dead for hundreds and hundreds of years, and he's going to come back. That seems pretty crazy. Does that seem crazy to you?
No.
How many does that sound crazy to? Michael Cox says it's crazy. Michael, coming from you, that's not all that crazy. Then, do you think it's crazy when Malachi says, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before that awesome, you know, day of the Lord come"? Hasn't Elijah the prophet been dead for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years? Yeah. Well, why is it so bizarre to think that the Antichrist has been, you know, did you know that Antiochus is referred to as the Antichrist of the Old Testament? He is. There's so many parallels, and the terminology that's used is identical, that I don't think this is such a wild, crazy idea. I don't think it's wild and crazy at all yet.
Bear with me.
I will.
You know, if the devil deals with demons, those are his workers in the world and whatnot, is it, instead of maybe, you know, having the same person resurrected, maybe it's a demon that came before and then comes again, different human being bodies, but the same.
Yeah, that is a possibility. And again, I'm not teaching this as fact. Okay, I'm throwing this out there as something I want you guys to consider as a possibility. All right?
That makes more sense. So the reanimation of the wicked.
Why not? Aren't the wicked going to be raised on the last day? He's going to resurrect all the wicked in the last day.
There's an angel that you would have to say that there was an angel who was manifest. Elijah, who's going to manifest through the future Elijah.
Yeah.
You're going to say the demon animated, you know, or was behind the old Antiochus and is behind the new one. You have to say the same about Elijah, that God made Elijah do all that stuff.
Yeah.
He did.
Well, he empowered him, but Elijah was acting according to his own volition. Yeah.
Well, it is a type because God is going to, or God has raised, but his son is going to return, and this is supposed to be you think Antichrist, today, is really like false Christ. It's a pseudo-Christ. So when Satan uses this tool to deceive many at the end of time, he's supposed to be this, like, unifier, false Messiah, and everyone will be a cult of this man. Well, if you think the type of what God's doing with his real son, that looks like Satan's son, that it would make sense.
Okay, yeah. Did you have some?
Also
says
that God's
going to
allow
a great
delusion.
Yes.
A great
what?
Great deception. Strong delusion.
Right. But where the problem, where that theory breaks down, is especially in chapter 11 when it keeps talking about this king doing all these things, and it uses the same referent for the events that have already happened during the time of Antiochus, and then it says, and in the time of the end, he's going to do this and this and this, and it goes on talking about what this human person has done. All right? To say, well, it's not the same human person really violates the language and the grammar that, you know, the way that the passage develops. I mean, you could say, well, it's, you know, it's not really all that literal. But if you tend to be more of a literalist like I am, that solution doesn't really solve the problem completely, especially in chapter 11. All right? Which we'll deal with it more when we get to chapter 11. I can hardly hear you up here. You have to be really loud. I'm sorry.
You're saying that you think that Antiochus will be resurrected in the end times of the Antichrist, that we already know that Christ may have resurrected. But the Antichrist is kind of like Satan. That we know Satan is the one.
Has Satan got the power to resurrect people? Could God give him the power to do it for this particular instance? Sure, he could. Can God allow it? Yeah. Can God hinder it? Yes. But see, it all depends on what God wants to happen. I don't think we can say it's impossible on that ground. All right. Again, I'm not teaching this as, you know, this is how it's going to play out. I don't know for sure. But look, this is the way I look at it. When I read the passage, I've read all the commentaries, everybody's best, taking their best shots at this passage, and nobody can explain it, at least not without explaining it away and saying it's not really literal, it's not really, 2,300 days and all that kind of nonsense. If you just take it for what it says, in my opinion, this is the only solution that actually works without having to force the text. All right? Now, am I being too literal? Maybe. Maybe. Have I ever been too literal before? Probably.
Yeah.
All right? Again, I just want, look, I think we should be careful about being too dogmatic about how things are going to play out in the future. I think we can be pretty dogmatic about how things have happened in the past, right? Exactly how certain prophecies are going to play out with what countries and all that kind of stuff, I think we have to be a little bit loose in our positions that we hold, okay? However, I also think that even an explanation that seems so bizarre to us, yet it seems to answer all the problems that these passages are putting in front of us, that people haven't been able to answer for, you know, Christian commentators and Jewish commentators haven't been able to answer how this prophecy could possibly have been fulfilled. And it's really remarkable because the book of Daniel is so precise, especially when we get to chapter 11, where it gives these kings of the Seleucid Empire and what they're going to do, and then in his place another king is going to stand up and he's going to do this. And if you follow the history, it's exactly what has happened. He talks about intermarriages between the Egyptians and the Seleucid Empire and how things break down and they fall apart. And these, if you go, you can look it up on Wikipedia if you want, and it's got the stories of how these things have actually played out. You don't even have to reference the Bible, and the Bible is very, very precise, and people look at that and they say, ah, the book of Daniel couldn't possibly have been written before that because it's so accurate. And then to throw something like this into the mix where it doesn't seem to fit anything. It doesn't seem to fit Antiochus, the 2300 days, and it doesn't fit what Revelation says about what the Antichrist is going to do in the end times. The period's too long. But when you put them together, it adds up right to the day. I mean, to me, it's too much of a coincidence. All right, it's too much of a coincidence to just be a coincidence. When there's no other explanation, and when you add them together, they add up to the very same thing. The temple was desolate without the morning and evening sacrifices for 2,300 days. And you add up Antiochus' time, you add up the time that the Antichrist is going to defile it, it's 2,300 days. It just doesn't seem like there's another reasonable explanation to me. Okay. Yeah, Tim.
So we have 3 years of Antiochus between his desolation and the Maccabees going through the cleansing. Yeah. And then the second time frame, that means that we would have from the midpoint of the tribulation, of the desolation there, that we would have a cleansing moment at the end to where a sacrifice would be done properly in the way that it's supposed to be, right?
Well, the temple would be cleansed, yes. It doesn't say a sacrifice is offered, it just says
okay. The temple would be cleansed at the end of, or before.
Well, his defilement, the defilement would end at the end of that period of time.
The defilement ends.
Yeah. And the sanctuary will be cleansed, it says.
Well, that sounds like the sanctuary that's there would be the one that would then continue into the kingdom.
Not necessarily. I mean, it doesn't mean that Christ has to reign from that particular sanctuary. It just is just saying that defilement comes to an end and it's cleansed according to the rituals of the law of Moses. And there are certain rituals in the law of Moses for cleansing of the sanctuary and so forth. It was done again, you guys probably remember, when Cyrus gave the decree after Jerusalem was destroyed. They came back, they rebuilt a new altar. They went through the proper rituals so that offerings could then be made at the temple. All right, so, yeah, Leah.
I just read the article about the early institutions, how they said, you know, we shouldn't look too much into the, you know, what tribe we'll be from and the number of the slaves, mark of the beast.
Yeah.
But, you know, like you're saying, we should hold it loosely until these 10 king comes mm-hmm. first, and then three of them give their authority to the beast.
Right.
But do you think that this interpretation sheds some light on what the mark of the beast would be or the number of his name?
I want to talk about the mark of the beast and the number of the beast in probably Thursday night, I think, is we're going to be talking about that, all right? And what that might mean with regard to this theory. So, again, this is a theory. This is something I want you to hold a little bit loosely, but I want you to be aware that this seems to me to be the most obvious way of reconciling the problems that Christian expositors have grappled with for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, trying to reconcile Daniel chapter 8 with the actual facts. So, yeah.
What are the other averages you can use to average out the lunar month that would give you with 2,299?
Well, it depends on when you spot the first new moon, when you first begin the count.
What was the question?
Okay. He's wanting to know how the average works out, you know, with a day or two. If you, depending on the year, you might be able to see the new moon on a particular day if the sun sets early enough when the new moon occurs. If it sets later, it'll take another day before you can observe it, so you wouldn't begin your count until a day later.
Also, when you see a little bit of the sliver.
You got to see the sliver, but if the sliver occurs before the sun sets sufficiently enough so that the sky is dark enough to be able to see that sliver, then you have to wait until the next night before you can actually see it to begin your count. Alright? So anyway, that's how that works. There's always that variable when we're dealing with time periods on the lunar calendar, on an observable lunar calendar. Alright. Yeah, Leah. No, I was talking about days, not years.
Oh, yeah.
It's days.
Yeah.
It's not years. It's the Seventh-day Adventists that, because they can't figure out any other way to make it add up either to Antiochus or the end times. Actually, there was a man named William Miller. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him. Back in the 1800s, he was an Adventist. The reason they were called Adventists is they were looking for the second advent of Christ. And he set a date for the second coming. I think it was 1840 somewhere. 44, was it? Thank you. 1844, and he had a huge following. Well, his calculation was based on this passage. He counted, but he made the days into years. So he was looking for 2,300 years until he thought the sanctuary would be cleansed, meaning Christ would return. So he was counting from where he thought Daniel was, and he counted it out, and that's what he got. And so everybody was selling all their possessions and waiting for Jesus to come back, and he never showed. Right? Well, the Seventh-day Adventist church, the Adventist group kind of fell apart because of that, and most of the people left. But some of them hung around, and they believed in William Miller, and they kept finding new ways to explain how he was actually right after all. It's just all invisible, you know, or something like that. And the Seventh-day Adventists have come out of that movement. Okay? And they still hold to that theory today for this passage. All right. Anybody help? Yeah, Ben.
You know, we talk about the prophecy teachers interpreting everything through geopolitics and current events and all that. Some of the big things I'm hearing from some of these guys is reinterpreting Daniel 8 in the Ram and the Goat because of verse 17, where it says, "Understand that the vision refers to the time of the end," and looking now for the Ram and the Goat scenario to play out.
Yeah, but he identifies it's the Medes and the Persians.
Yeah, I mean, you tell him that.
And it says it's the first Greek king. I mean, that's Alexander the Great. How can he be the first Greek king now?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, come on. But But, you know, a lot of people, they have to have, everybody's got to have a new theory, so I guess that's my new theory, but.
What would you tell them when they ask about, when it says the time of the end?
Because, well, look what it says in verse 24. And in the latter time of their kingdom, it's talking about an end, but it's not the end of time. It's talking about the end of this, or coming towards the end of the Seleucid Empire. It's the breakup of Alexander's kingdom into four and towards the end of their kingdoms. And really, this wasn't far from the end of their kingdoms because the Roman Empire swallowed all this up not too long after all. All right, so that's when these things were going to play out, at least the first part of it. But, yeah, go ahead.
If the 2300 includes the end, then it is the end times as well.
It is both. Yeah, yeah. All right, so I know this is a big concept to swallow. And again, you know, take it for what it's worth. Go ahead.
I know Elijah has a special or deep connection with God.
Yeah.
Makes it like this so terrible, I guess, that you think that's the end of
it. Yes. But is it the actual same person? That really is where the rubber hits the road. Is it really the same God? And when we get to chapter 11, I think it's inescapable that it is the same God. All right, but we'll reserve judgment until we get there. Yeah, Jim. I don't think so. A clone is a different person, even if it was possible. What's that? But it's not really the same person. How do we define a person? Because look, if you're a couple and you have a child, does that child carry your DNA?
Yeah.
Yes. Is that you?
No.
Is it the same person? What is a person? All right. Let me ask you this: a Siamese twin has two heads, but shares the lower part of a body. Is that one or two people?
Two people.
Why is it two people?
Right.
There's two consciousness, right? A person really is not defined by DNA, not defined by how many arms and legs you have. It's defined by a conscious mind, right? That has self-awareness, that can think and reason on its own. Right, that's a person. Well, if it's the same person, it has to be that same conscious mind. A clone would be a duplicate. It'd be a copy having the same physical characteristics, but it wouldn't have the same experiences, the same memories, the same consciousness as the original person, just like a child doesn't have the same as his parents, even though they share the same DNA. All right, so I don't think that solves the problem, just like I don't think a demon that possessed Antiochus is the same demon that's going to possess the Antichrist. I don't think that solves the problem, especially when we get to chapter 11 and we look at the language that's being used, which says this king is going to do this and this and this, and then all of a sudden it jumps in and says, and at the time of the end he's going to do this and this and this and this. And when you get there, it's clearly things that Antiochus did not do. He died before those other things occurred, but yet they're said to occur, and they're going to occur in the end times. You know, how does this guy leap from, you know, 165 BC all the way to the end of time, and it still sounds, you know, as far as all the grammar, as far as we can tell, it's talking about the same person. How does he do that?
It's an
unthinked
frog.
Yeah, he leapfrogged, right?
Right.
All right, so again, I'm just throwing this out as a possible way to resolve a problem that has been a really big problem in Christian apologetics, if you will, for a very long time that hasn't really been solved. Not in any literal or meaningful way. To me, this solves the problem, and it also solves other problems. I mean, the reasons why it's called, Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desolation, yet it already happened. You know, stuff like that.
Is the class for this week, is it being posted online?
Not sure yet. I got to see how the videos turn out. We'll see. All right, again, don't go out and start teaching that this is Tim's new theory. It's a possibility. I just want to throw it out as one possibility, which I'm leaning more and more towards the more I study. Okay? What's that?
No.
Okay.
Bad word, lost it.
I've lost it. I'm over the edge. But it wouldn't, and that wouldn't be the first time that I was accused of that, would it? So anyway, all right. We'll look at we're gonna get into Daniel 9, and we're gonna talk about the 70 weeks and all that. But after we get through that, we're gonna deal with chapters 10 through 12, which is one continuous narrative. 10 through 12 is pretty awesome, actually, because in the past, you know, with Daniel 2, with Daniel 8, with Daniel 7, you see these visions being given in these allegories, and then these sort of explanations being given, you know, by the partial explanations, I should say, being given, but yet there still seems to be some ambiguity. But when you get to chapter 10 through 12, Daniel, basically the angel comes and he just says, Daniel, here's what's going to happen, okay? This king is going to, you know, do this, and he's going to be overthrown, and this king is going to come in his place. And there's no more allegory. It's all stating literally what's going to happen in sequence. All right, when we get there, I think it's pretty clear. And it seems to, in my opinion, add a lot of credibility to this line of reasoning. So anyway, now if this is true, it answers one very important question. A question that Tim and I have in contention between us. And that is the nationality of the Antichrist. But, again, it's still an issue. All right? Anybody want to comment or kick me out? Okay. Anybody want to leave? All right, so I guess that's it for tonight. Anybody got anything else to add? Comments? Yeah.
What's this guy? He's going to be resurrected.
Just
talking about the fatal wound. Going back and back. How are you
going to
know that this guy was resurrected? How are they
going to
know that?
You know what's funny about him is he's this little horn. He's called the little horn. In fact, I think I mentioned that in the morning service. In chapter 7, we have this little horn that comes up among the 10 horns on the fourth beast, right? And it's clear that the 10 horns are in the end times. There's no doubt about it, because Revelation, I mean, they're the toes on Nebuchadnezzar's image, you know, and the stone strikes the feet, so that's where, and it says in the days of these kings, the God of heaven is going to set up a kingdom. So that's clear that the 10 kings are alive at the time of the second coming. We get to Revelation chapter 17. It talks about these 10 kings that are going to give their, you know, authority and sovereignty over to the Antichrist. So they're going to reign with him for this short period of time. So we've got those 10 kings there. And in Daniel 7, this Antichrist character is called the Little Horn, right? Well, he's also called, Antiochus is called the Little Horn in chapter 8 as well. It's the exact same term. You know, so we've got these terms that are being shared, the little horn, the abomination of desolation. You know, this terminology between these two characters is clearly connected. Yeah. Yes. Antiochus was a unique guy. He was actually a mix of Persian, and I think his mother was Persian, if I remember correctly. His father was Syrian. But what's strange about him is, as Daniel says in another passage, he will not worship the gods of his fathers. Because rather than worship the Persian and Syrian gods, he instead taught, or he required his subjects to worship the Greek gods. He tried to impose Greek mythology and Greek philosophy onto all the peoples that he conquered. He was the prime instigator or mover of Hellenizing the cultures that he conquered, and he was not of Greek ancestry himself. You know? So, but anyway, that's does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think there's a reason why we're having the issues now with Syria.
Yeah. I think you need, listen, when we get to Daniel 11, you're going to see that the king of the north and the king of the south not only play prominent roles during Antiochus' reign, but they're going to play a prominent role in the end times. A conflict between the king of the north and the king of the south. Antiochus was the king of the north at the time. All right, Ptolemy was the king of the south at the time. Alright, now what we'll see in chapter 11 is Antiochus died, and the narrative continues to go on saying what he was going to do. He was going to invade Egypt another time, but Antiochus never invaded Egypt another time, but yet the Bible says he's going to do that. And then it says that at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands for your people, will stand up, and there will be a time of trouble, such as has not been since the beginning of creation till the end. And Jesus quoted that passage and talked about the great tribulation in the future. And yet it says that it's going to occur at that time, when the passage is talking about Antiochus invading Egypt another time, which he hasn't actually done yet. He died before he did it. Okay? We're going to look at some of those things, and we'll follow some of the history of the parts that have been fulfilled. And all of a sudden, Antiochus disappears, and he doesn't fulfill the rest. And it's right at that point where it says, and at the time of the end, he shall do this, and this, and this. And it's the same guy. Alright? So, yeah.
I have a comment for Thursday.
Okay.
For Thursday.
Okay. I'll reserve a spot for you. Yeah. All right, now, I encourage you to find holes in this theory. All right? See if you can poke a hole in it. See if you can... Yes, I wasn't talking to you.
Oh, sorry. I had one time.
Go ahead.
If given Revelation 'he receives a wound by a sword, referring... That doesn't fit well with his guts being spilled.
Yes, it does. Yes, because there is a passage, which I thought of that already, by the way, that specifically says that a man who the same thing happened to, that it was the sword of God that did it to him. All right? So,
how Christ destroys him when he returns as well, the sword of his mouth.
In fact, there was a plague. There was also a plague that God brought because of David numbering the people. You remember that? And God brought a plague on the people with his awful, awful illness, and many of them died because of it, and it's called the sword of the Lord that took people out. So God has a sword, and he takes people out also. What's that?
In his mouth.
Well, in Revelation he does, yeah. All right, so anyway, good try, though. I'll hand it to you for a good try. Yeah, Mike.
This might be a bit of speculation, but where do you think his resurrection would fall?
Before he comes.
Before, obviously, before the midpoint.
Yeah.
How far?
I don't know. But I'll tell you what I think. All right. Because when you read chapter 11, it talks about a second invasion from Syria back down to Egypt. He's going to have to be some kind of a ruler in Syria at the time that that happens. So. They won't, that's not going to occur until the midpoint.
Maybe they don't know who he is.
Perhaps. I don't know all these details. Okay. If this theory is right, I still don't know exactly how it's going to play out. We're not told that. The only question I can say is it appears to me that if it's the same person, it seems to solve a lot of problems in the text that have gone unanswered for hundreds of years. Alright? That's all I'll say. So I think there's a strong possibility that this is how it's going to play out. But I will not go to the place of saying this is definitely how it's going to play out. Okay? We'll see how it's going to play out. Yeah, you can have it.
Okay. Daniel 11:40, the king of the south attacks him. But also the king of the north comes against him. So
him there is the king of the south, not Antiochus. You read the passage a little more closely. You're getting your pronouns mixed up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.